Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Student loan debt in the United States is over $1.45 trillion. And a recent study found that over 12% of adults in the Bay Area owe a collective $26.6 billion in debt. The numbers are staggering. Student loan debt has doubled in the past decade and is now the second largest source of consumer debt. So why has student loan debt increased so much in the last decade? How has the student loan industry contributed to making the debt bigger, not smaller? And in a region where it is already so expensive to live, how is this debt affecting the choices that people make? To discuss these issues, I'm joined in the studio by Jacob Dumais, the Manager of Policy and Partners in San Francisco's Office of Financial Empowerment, which co-authored an April 2019 study on Bay Area student loan debt, and Jacob leads the office's Consumer Financial Protection and Student Loan Debt Initiatives. Welcome, Jacob.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we're also joined by Juliana Fredman. She's a consumer protection attorney with Bay Area Legal Aid who works directly with low-income clients through the Legal Aid's clinic. And she's a graduate of UC Hastings Law School. Welcome, Juliana.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Suzanne Martindale. She's a senior policy counsel and Western States legislative manager for Consumer Reports. And her areas of expertise include student loans, banking, payments, debt collection, and small dollar credit. And she's the author of Degrees of Debt, Stories from Student Loan Borrowers Highlight Urgent Need for Reform. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you very much.
And we also want you to join the conversation, and we're going to open the phone lines in just about 20 minutes. And the number to call at that point is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But you can email or text us now with any questions or comments at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. We want to hear from you if you have student loan debt and how it's affecting you and your family. Well, Jacob, let me start with you. Can you describe for listeners the typical student loan debt loan debt load for a Bay Area resident?
Sure. And typical is tough. The cases are all over the map. So as you described, $26.6 billion, it's a huge number in the Bay Area at large. The average debt that a borrower in the Bay Area faces is about $34,000, a little over $34,000. You can talk in averages and you can talk in medians. The median is somewhat less than that. Both have spiked over the last 15 years. So really the story, as I'm sure we'll get into, is below the broad averages and really when you get down to people who are most at risk and most burdened by that debt.
And along with the San Francisco Federal Reserve, the San Francisco Office of Financial Empowerment, where you were, conducted a study on regional student loan debt. And can you describe some of the findings that really stood out to you from that report?
I'd be happy to and want to give a shout out for sure to the Federal Reserve, which has been great partners on this work. So one of the things we found that kind of jumps off the page at people is when you look back at 2003, which we were able to do, to today, and you see across the board, you see huge increases in the percentage of households that are borrowing to attend college, the amount that they're borrowing, the number of people who are delinquent, and the number of people in default. But below that, I think the biggest takeaways here are the biggest problems in terms of delinquency and default, people really falling behind, are in the poorest neighborhoods. They're in the neighborhoods with the highest percentage of Black and Latinx borrowers. And they're not among people with huge six-figure debts. They're really among relatively small debts below $15,000, even as low as $1,000 to $5,000 can cause a huge burden for people.
So it's definitely some surprising findings and some imbalances there in terms of the demographics. And Suzanne Martindale, let me bring you into this conversation. So what stands out to you in terms of some of those surprising findings about student loan debt right here in the Bay Area?
Well, I think that, you know, we all hear a narrative in this country that if you continue your education, it's going to give you a leg up. But unfortunately, we're in a situation now where the kind of economic opportunities that are available to you, you know, that really determines the outcomes you're going to see before you've even started enrolling in education. It is, in fact, the more you dig into the data that the San Francisco Fed and Office of Financial Empowerment did, as well as some of the data that we've seen from other parts of the country, you see that there's a strong correlation between people who come from low-income zip codes, have borrowed small amounts, and are also more likely to be delinquent. The smaller amount suggests that they maybe did not spend as much time in school, i.e. they may not have finished a program. So they are, have a debt but no credential. And that can really put people into, you know, into a downward spiral. And but again, in particular, it does seem to be the case that people who are coming from underserved circumstances to begin with are finding that even trying to get a little bit of extra education, it's not actually working out in the way that you would intend.
And so these small amounts that people are borrowing, is that coming from for-profit colleges, or is there a profile of the type of institution that people are borrowing to attend?
Absolutely. I mean, there is also a problem here with certain communities being targeted specifically by, you know, not just career programs, but often career programs and other offerings from for-profit colleges. They may be brick and mortar. We're increasingly seeing a lot of out-of-state distance education programs that are offering online-only courses, making promises that you can do a short-term program and it's going to lead to a great career. And after many years of, you know, and this is something that Julian will be able to speak to very well, of advocates raising the alarm bells of saying, you know, these, you know, people are not getting the education and training they were promised, and they're going into debt for this experience, that really can lead to a perfect storm that can arguably put someone in a worse position, a far worse position than they were before they even attempted to complete a program.
And so what's sort of the source of the problem here? I mean, is it the student loan industry, or is it some of these for-profit educational institutions or other educational institutions that are sort of enticing people to start but not finish their degrees?
Well, this is a very, very complex issue, and there are multiple factors that clearly have set us up to be in the position that we're in right now. You know, as more and more the kinds of jobs that we need in this country are in many cases requiring different specialized training, it's not so simple anymore to just go through high school, you're going to find a job that will pay you a living wage and you're okay, and then those who choose to do so can really continue on with post-secondary. These days, we don't really give people much of a choice. Either you will be in a minimum wage job or working in the gig economy, perhaps, without continuing your education, or you're going to need to continue your education be able to hopefully find a job that will pay you a living wage. And then, of course, the trade-off of that is that you are very likely, almost certainly likely these days, unless you're independently wealthy, to have to take out loans in order to even access that education. You know, and of course, you know, why is it so expensive? Well, you know, there is data to suggest that particularly at, you know, public education systems, state budgets, you know, were slashed in the 2000s. They haven't even recovered since the financial crisis. And so much, you know, many school systems ended up raising tuition to recoup their costs, and that shifted the burden, the financial burden, onto students and their families, as opposed to the public subsidizing education as we used to do more so in previous decades. And so that puts the sticker price up, and then more people need to borrow. And that's, you know, there are a lot of different reasons there. But then absolutely there are some sectors in particular that have been allowed to access taxpayer dollars without providing anything remotely approximating a quality education, so that the whole experience was even worth it for the student.
So it's obviously very complex, lots of factors. And I would note that at least in California, you can sort of trace back tuition increases at the UCs where I work to Prop 13 and the, mm-hmm. some of the tax cutting that happened in the 70s, which you could draw a line to that to higher tuition payments and therefore higher student loan debt. So Juliana Fredman, I wanted to bring you into this discussion. You work, as I mentioned in the intro here, with Bay Area Legal Aid. Can you describe a bit about what you see in terms of the clients that you work with and what you're seeing in terms of Bay Area student loan debt among your client population?
Sure. Well, Bay Area Legal Aid, we have consumer law clinics, and we go out into a lot of the communities, I think, that Jacob has identified in his report as having kind of higher student loan debt and default rates. And, you know, we really do see the gamut. I mean, I really did start noticing a few years back that one thing that was really universal, no matter who walked through the door, is that most of them had some sort of student loans. And so there's kind of two factors, right? There's two kind of buckets of people. You might have people who went to a college and are just having a hard time making ends meet. They're not getting proper information from their servicer about how to get their loans into some sort of manageable form. And then really we do see a tremendous amount of people who've been targeted by for-profit colleges. I mean, the most, you know, largest and most spectacular example of that locally would be the Corinthian colleges, which closed back in 2015. But there's really a lot of schools out there that do these kind of high-pressure sales tactics. I mean, anyone who sat and watched daytime television will see that the commercials promise you the world. And when they, when people call up, I mean, you hear the stories over and over again. It's like, get them through the door, always be closing, right? The people come in, and it's like they fill out all the paperwork for you. They want you to get out having already signed up for the loans. A lot of time, people don't even realize that they've taken out loans. They've been told they've got financial aid, but they haven't been given disclosures, and they haven't really gotten the information they need. And even if they do finish the program, the promised jobs and the wages just aren't there.
Yeah. So, do you have any Trump University graduates or near graduates?
Not out here. We don't have any Trump University
graduates. All right. So that's one thing I guess we could be thankful for. And what has surprised you? I mean, when you're first starting work in this field, I mean, is there something that really jumps out at you as surprising in terms of what you're seeing on the ground with people with student loan debt?
I mean, it's all kind of – there's many different kinds of things that can be quite shocking. I mean, one thing that I've seen a lot of is senior citizens, some of which – some of whom have loans for their – you know, that they've taken out Parent PLUS loans for their children to go to school. But many others who went to school back in the 70s or 80s borrowed a small amount of money. And student loan debt didn't used to be collectible forever. That changed in the 90s. And so what happened to a lot of these people is the loans they, you know, kind of – they were unable to pay. They didn't hear anything for years and years. And suddenly these loans have come back. They are huge for all, from all the years of interest and fees added. And now they're taking people's Social Security or, you know, a portion of people's Social Security. And that was really shocking for me to see, you know, people, elderly people getting their.
Yeah, low-income seniors who have this, you know, debt coming back out of nowhere. So definitely sounds like a horror story. Jacob Dumais, I wanted to go back to you, something you mentioned in terms of this Federal Reserve study, just in terms of the racial imbalances and the gender imbalances that really jump out, at least to me, when I'm looking at this report. So can you describe a little bit in more detail, you know, what those are about and what are some of the explanations for why we see these imbalances?
Yeah, I can give it my best shot. I'll put it that way. You know, we used for the data in this report credit panel data from Equifax, and it's really valuable in sort of understanding someone's balance sheet in terms of the various debts that they owe. Unfortunately, it doesn't tell you the race or ethnicity of the borrower. It doesn't tell you where they went to school, what kind of income. So what we did is overlaid where people live who owe this debt and how much they owe and what position they're in repayment with the neighborhood characteristics where they live. And so that's what leads us to understand, for example, where you might see, you know, Bay Area wide just under 10% default rates, you see that spike in the Bayview. You see that spike in Vallejo and East Oakland in all these neighborhoods that share certain things in common. Very poor, you know, low incomes, and far higher numbers and far higher percentages of Black and Hispanic residents than the rest of the Bay Area. Why that is, there's a number of reasons. I would lead with, I think, one of the things we've been coming back to, which is sort of the bottom dropping out on the wage market over the past years. And so when you have a white bachelor's degree recipient, a college grad, who as a median makes about $64,000 a year as of 2018, that's $13,500 more than their Black counterpart and about 11,000 some odd more than their Hispanic counterparts. So you're already starting out with a very uneven playing field. You have more people who are renters who are rent burdened. You have more people who are childcare burdened. So that's just the life kind of aspect coming into play. And then as we've heard alluded to, the for-profit schools, not only are they making some sort of predatory practices, but they're targeting certain areas. I mean, there's maybe a third of all college students are either Hispanic or African American, but they make up half of the for-profit student body. So there's all of this kind of comes together in a toxic mix. And I'd say in the Bay Area in particular, it's sort of the wealth and income inequality, the racial wealth gap coming back to bite us again.
Although I note that even for controlling for income and parental education, degree attained in grades, et cetera, there's still an unexplained 11-point gap in default rates, at least between African-American and white students. And this is from Judith Scott Clayton, a professor at Columbia University. And so I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, this seems like something that, you know, you couldn't just pin to, you know, wage inequality, that sort of thing. Any thoughts about what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And I think, I hope that there are books being written currently to try and really tease this out. But again, what I come back to is this is not like necessarily a new lesson to us. It's the same lesson as sort of, you know, discrimination impacting the housing market and impacting the job market. And yes, the wages reflect that for sure. So people are often first generation to attend college. I mean, you can add that layer to it. So you don't have anyone to necessarily guide you through the process. I think we're lacking, and we're going to work on it in San Francisco. We're lacking the kind of counseling and guidance that to understand how to borrow and how to make comparisons with school and how to get not just to college, but all the way through and choose the right program that's going to work for you. So I can't claim to explain that entire gap that she's talking about there, but she's bringing up some really shocking statistics. I mean, I think another thing that she points to is black college graduates have a higher dropout rate than white college dropouts by several points. And so do I know exactly why that is? No, I can point to a number of factors, and I don't think any one of them, you know, fully bears the blame.
So more research is needed to really explain what's going on here. And Suzanne Martindale, did you want to comment on some of these racial and gender imbalances? Just, you know, the statistic on the terms of the gender imbalance, you know, women hold nearly two-thirds of the outstanding loan debt in the U.S., but make up only 57% of bachelor degrees and 58% of graduate degrees. So we're seeing all these imbalances that you know, could use some explanation, I would think, so we can start to address these problems, right?
Yeah. I think what these student loan outcomes bear out is it's just another articulation of the structural injustices that women and people of color experience every day, and it plays its way out in a number of different ways. And here it's no different. Demos did a study the think tank out of New York did a study a few months back and found that 12 years after starting school, a white male borrower has paid down 44% of his debt balance, and that same person, if they were a black woman, would have seen their debt balance grow by 13%. So there are lots of different economic factors that could be contributing to that, but of course there are societal, and there are issues with implicit bias and who gets hired, who's more likely to get hired for which job. I mean, there's a lot that really goes into this, but it does call back the initial question of does it make sense for us to be pushing people to get an education after high school, but then creating a financial aid, quote unquote, system that basically is just debt, so that most people have to go to debt to access the education. I think the way that undercuts any benefit that an individual actually receives, I think that this is just bearing that out very clearly.
Mm-hmm. And Suzanne, just stay with you on this topic of borrowing versus repayment, mm-hmm. Because taking out the debt, there's obviously a lot of help from college and maybe banks to ease that loan process. But on the repayment side, it seems like a very different story. Can you tell us a bit about how loan servicing can get a borrower into trouble?
Absolutely. Part of the reason why we have a $1.5 trillion debt balance that just seems to keep growing, and why we hear that a million people are defaulting a year, is because we have an utterly broken student loan servicing industry. It is completely broken. It is an utter failure. There are a lot of different policy changes that happened over the years with the federal aid programs, but one big thing that happened was after the financial crisis, when all of a sudden the old system where banks were making loans and the government was guaranteeing them, and the banks were themselves in crisis. And so after some pieces of legislation moved through, we converted into a system where now the federal government directly makes loans, but then contracts out all the back-end servicing functions to these companies that the names, Sally Mae and Nelnet and Great Lakes. And these are actually some of the very same companies that used to be the lenders. But they basically, the trade-off was, okay, that you're not going to be lending anymore through this guaranteed loan program. Oh, but we'll keep you on as servicers. We'll pay you money so that you can be the gatekeeper and you're taking people's payments and you're handling the servicing aspects for people when they're repaying. But as we have learned, as some of us personally, I myself am a borrower and have experienced problems with loan servicers, but of course all the investigations, state attorney general lawsuits around the country, even a lawsuit that under the previous administration, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau brought against Navient, which was then the largest servicer, they've well documented that borrowers are being failed at every stage of repayment. We have a very, very complex system for repaying loans. Different kinds of loans may qualify for different kinds of repayment plans. There have been moves over the years to tack on some additional payment plans that we call income-driven, which means that what you owe every month is calculated as a percentage of your income. It's a very, very good short-term default prevention measure to make sure that, you know, if you couldn't do the regular standard 10-year plan, there's still a way for you to be current, not subject to collections and some of the bad things that can happen to you there, so long as you're making that monthly payment. But of course, that is a complex process, and you have to do paperwork and verify your income, and you have to re-verify your income every single year. And it's very confusing, and only with time and practice and support can you really get the hang of it. A lot of us that were some of the early guinea pigs trying to use these plans ourselves ended up with problems, had paperwork get lost, saw delays. And some of these delays and mix-ups can result in having to put a pause on your payments, and then interest is added to your loans, and then that interest may ultimately capitalize and be added to your loan balance. And so that's how people's actual balances can grow, even though they're just trying to pay it down.
So it's a very, very complicated repayment, and it's sad to see that so easy to take out the loans, but so hard to navigate this repayment system. I want to talk more about that, but first I want to let listeners know that this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Jacob Dume, Manager of Policy and Partners in San Francisco's Office of Financial Empowerment, Juliana Fredman, a consumer protection attorney with Bay Area Legal Aid, and Suzanne Martindale, Senior Policy Counsel for Consumer Reports. And we're talking about drowning in student debt and how you can get out of it. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you have student loans? Are you having trouble repaying them? The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page, which we are monitoring. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using at cityvisionskalw. Well, let's go to the phone lines. We have Leia from San Francisco dialing in. Leia, welcome to City Visions.
Hi there. So I'm about less than a year out of grad school, and I haven't begun paying off my loans yet, my federal loans, because I don't make enough money to do so right now. And my plan has always been to enroll in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program or to go to the nonprofit sector to help pay off my loans. But my biggest fear is that I'm going to start going that route and that program is going to be eliminated. I know there's been some talks about that. And I'm just wondering what kind of options are there for people like me who really need some kind of help through a program to help pay off our loans?
All right, Leah. Well, let me direct that question to Juliana Fredman from Bay Area Legal Aid. Juliana, you want to take that one?
Sure. Well, public service loan forgiveness is a good option that exists right now. I mean, in terms of what's going to happen in the future, that's a hard thing to predict. But I, you know, one would hope that people who are enrolled in the program and making payments under it would somehow be grandfathered in, although no guarantees. So I think the important thing to do if you're doing public service loan forgiveness is make sure that you have the correct kind of loans. Make sure all your loans are direct loans or they won't be included. And make sure you're on the right kind of repayment plan. So you can enroll right now into an income-driven repayment plan. If you're not making much money, your payments will be set very low, even as low as zero. But that time does count towards some theoretical future forgiveness, whether or not you enter into public service. So it's, you know, if you're done with your grace period, you might as well not leave them in forbearance.
All right. And Leah, we certainly want people to go into public service, and it seems like a critical feature. And just following up on Leah's question, Suzanne, do you have thoughts about what we can do to try to minimize people's debt who are going into some sort of public service profession?
Right. Well, this is a lot of us, you know, spend time as advocates trying to think through how to make the system more navigable. It is just so structurally complex because Congress has kind of tacked on Band-Aids along the way as opposed to really overhauling the financial aid system. So unfortunately, there's no silver bullet here. I think that, if you are working at some like a government job or certainly a 501c3 tax exempt nonprofit, it is in the congressional law that employment counts. Julianne is absolutely correct. If you have a direct federal loan, some direct from the government and you're in an income-driven repayment plan and you're doing that public service job full-time, then you should be able to be on track. There are forms that you need to or you should be filling out and submitting. They're called employment certification forms that you send that in, and then the department verifies that you're in eligible employment. It's a way to kind of track your progress. They'll tell you, these are how many payments you've made that have qualified. And we do encourage people to do that. You can literally Google PSLF certification form and follow the instructions. But I would say PSLF is not going away unless Congress gets rid of it. And Congress does not seem well poised anytime soon to change this law or get much of anything done. So I hope that that's somewhat comforting.
That's a good thing, I suppose, if inaction is good.
So, but I would say, like, your fears are not, unfounded in that, this program has been around since 2007, which means the first 10 years recently came up, and at least the initial numbers when they came out of people who'd actually gone after their 10 years of payment and applied for forgiveness was about 1% actually got their discharge, because the program was so complicated. You really do have to make sure it's the right kind of loans, the right kind of payment plan, and the right kind of job. So it's not...
So you got to go to law school to be able to read these contracts to repay your
if that even helps, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, Leah, thank you so much for your question. And let's go back to the phone lines. We have Ariane from San Francisco. Ariane, good evening and welcome to City Visions.
Thank you for taking my call. Just a couple comments. One, I thought it was interesting that your guest alluded to bailing out the banks, and the banks can borrow 90% of anything that they have in the bank. So if they have $1, they can borrow $9. And that there's a totally different attitude towards others, like ordinary working people and people who are not corporations, when it comes to their debt, the kind of judgment and morality and Calvinism that we look at for people who have debt. And then I want to underscore this: when we look at people of color and indigent people and people who go to community college, I did work in a community college for a year in the student health department, and many people who are who have less than means, they're working, and they're working maybe even full time while they're attending college, and that compromises their ability to do well at college and to sustain their motivation for college, because they're often tired. They may be a single mom. They may just be trying to pay for their basic bills and not have enough.
So it's a double burden on those individuals. Well, Ariane, I'm happy to ask the guest to comment on that, but did you have a specific question or did you want to share those observations?
I just want to share that may be also why people are not graduating. And So we really have to understand where our commitments lie.
Absolutely. Well, Ariane, thank you for those comments. And actually, let me let Jacob Dumais weigh in on that. As part of that study that came out, was this something that you found in the data to sort of confirm Ariane's observations at a broader scale?
Well, I don't think we found it directly in our data as much, but I think we looked a lot at secondary data, and we're blessed at having even some local folks. So TCAS, the Institute for College Access and Success here in Oakland, has looked at people who are attending the UC system and CSUs and community colleges, often who have tuition largely covered. And so people think often tuition, but it's really the rising costs of these other factors, particularly when, as Ariane points out, particularly when you're having to work 10, 20, 30 plus hours a week in order to cover those costs. So food, certainly housing, transportation, childcare, healthcare. And when you have to do all that, it's not uncommon to have your grades slip a little bit, your focus slip, and then you end up potentially not completing, or you don't complete as strongly as you would like. So I think that is for sure part of this, and that TCAS study really showed that throughout the California public higher education system, there's a huge gap and a huge burden on people that's forcing them to work too much, I think, for college students.
Well, it's interesting how the cost of living really does contribute to all of this. As you say, it's not just the tuition, but if you have a high housing cost, which we do here in the Bay Area among other high costs, you're gonna see that. And let's see, Julianne, I wanted to let you weigh in also on Ariane's comment, because I know you're dealing with a client population, and are you seeing what what Ariane is seeing in terms of the burdens and the kind of the lifestyles that contribute to the need to take on this kind of debt.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, many of my clients that I see, you know, they don't have a lot of family support or family money to help them get through school. So they definitely are trying to do it on their own. I would say that community college, the costs are so much lower. It's, you know, compared to the kinds of loans people are taking out to the same programs at Heald College, for example. You know, we see the community college maybe as part of the solution potentially because those people have much lower loans and they can take their time to get through and not have $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in debt.
So something to keep in mind for folks out there, or you know, trying to juggle this. And I should also point out that that report that Jacob has been discussing for the Federal Reserve, I mean, definitely says don't get a higher education. We want people to get higher education, but you know, so we don't want the takeaway to be education's bad, but that we need to address the economics around it. So this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Jacob Dume, Manager of Policy and Partners in San Francisco's Office of Financial Empowerment. We're also joined by Juliana Fredman, a consumer protection attorney with the Bay Area Legal Aid, and Suzanne Martindale, Senior Policy Counsel for Consumer Reports. And we invite you to call in with questions or comments. If you have student loans and are having trouble repaying them, we want to hear from you. Or if you have ideas for how we could try to address this problem, we'd also love to hear your thoughts. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. But we have another caller standing by. Grace from San Francisco has a question for the panelists. Grace, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, for taking my call. My situation is a little complex. I luckily have my BA, and that was all paid for. But as I grew older in 1998, I decided to enroll in a for-profit school called Antioch for their MFA program in writing. And I was encouraged to enroll by a friend who was teaching at the school. I qualified for a $3,000 loan for the first semester. I went to the first week, which was actually a remote program, but the first week you go and you show up on campus. I found the program to be completely inadequate and not something I was looking for. So I went to the dean and I said, I don't want to be in this program. I want to withdraw. She said, fine, you can withdraw. So I withdrew. And the loan, she did not release the loan back to the lender or whatever. So it's been since 1998. I just decided to pay on it because I was making good money in my 30s, and I paid $85 a month for, I think it was, what, I'm now 57. What is that, like 32 years? And I owe $3,000. I've paid $8,000. Now I owe $12,000. And I withdrew. It's documented. I don't know what to do. Can you advise me?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's pass that. First of all, I'm sorry about this challenge you're having to repay this. And let Juliana Fredman weigh in, and we'll see if others want to weigh in as well.
Thank you.
Well, I can't advise you, because I don't know, you know, all the details of your situation. Obviously, there is a federal loan.
Yes.
There is a federal loan discharge called unpaid refund, and you might want to look and see whether you might qualify to have any part of that loan discharge. I can't tell from the information I have, but I would definitely Google that and read up on it and see whether you think that it fits your circumstances.
All right. And Jacob Dume, do you want to weigh in?
Well, I will weigh in with a plug for those who have really difficult questions. There's going to be a lot of people listening and not listening today. So in addition to hoping that your call-in show can answer your questions sometimes, we're so lucky at the city to have, you know, my boss, Treasurer Jose Cisneros, and Mayor Breed and their departments really invested in finding some solutions now. And one of the things that we have already taken steps to do, our office has partnered with the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development and Bay Area Legal Aid so that people like Juliana and her colleagues are available in San Francisco on the second Thursday and the fourth Thursday of the month. And I'm going to look to you, Juliana. The second Thursday of the month is at Meta, I believe. But this is all on the Bay Area Legal Aid website, so don't worry, you can find it. But the two locations are at Mission Economic Development Agency, or Meta, which is in the Mission at Mission and 19th, and at the San Francisco Law Library, which is right near Civic Center at 1145 Market Street. So if you have these tough, thorny questions, how do I get my loan discharged? I don't know what's going on. I have my wages garnished. I'm in debt problems. Please do call Bay Area Legal Aid and sign up for one of those clinics.
All right. So some helpful resources there for folks. So, Grace, we appreciate you calling in with that question and wish you good luck to try to solve it. And we've also posted a link to Bay Area Legal Aid on our website for this show. So we'll have some – and maybe we can put these other resources that Jacob, you just mentioned as well on the website. So you can check back in that way if you missed it. One thing that Grace's comment and problem brings up is this issue about the statute of limitations. On credit card debt, it's 4 years, and it seems like it's easier to get rid of a gambling debt in bankruptcy than it is a student loan debt. And Suzanne, do you want to weigh in on what's going on here? Why we have the statute of limitations problem? I mean, it seems like Grace, you know, is a good example of that, where she's got this, you know, kind of age old debt here that's now, you know, the interest payments are more than what the actual loan was.
Yeah, you know, it's very common in the law that if someone wants to assert a legal claim, you know, file a case against you, they have to do it within a certain amount of time. And the idea is that, you know, when you file a case, you need to have evidence, and over time, evidence, documents, memories fade, right? So there should be an endpoint past which certainly something like this, where you're collecting on a debt, it should stop. The problem is that there was a change to the law made a little more than 20 years ago that made it so that for federal loan, for any federal debt, so this could be like a tax debt too, there simply is no statute of limitations. So if you owe a debt to the federal government, they can come after you into your grave. And that, combined with the fact that that changes were made over a series of decades, culminating most recently with overhaul of the bankruptcy code in 2005, that made it so difficult to discharge what are called qualified education loans in bankruptcy. And these days, to get out from under one of these debts, whether it's a federal loan or a private student loan, you have to plead undue hardship. And Congress never really defined what that meant. And so judges have been kind of trying to figure it out on the fly, case by case. And so it's been very difficult. So all of these things as well, important to point out here that then there's no incentive, certainly for the servicer acting on behalf of the federal government to make sure that you're current, because they know they can, you know, they know that this can get kicked to collections and they can just keep coming after you. So the incentives are totally misaligned. And as, you know, we'll talk about here on the show, there's not enough legal accountability for these companies when they get in the way and cause your problems, then make things worse while you're trying to repay and you're struggling.
So what's going on? It seems like a lot of this is kind of a political problem, you know, that there's undue influence perhaps from certain sectors of the economy or the political map. I mean, can you explain a little bit of what the dynamics are behind why it seems like these policies are either dysfunctional or just really sort of unjust in terms of their impacts on people?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you know, as is often the case, you know, the people in power write the policies. And how do people get into power? You know, we still have, although we're making, I think, you know, very progress in multiple jurisdictions, including in, you know, the U.S. Congress, most notably the House of Representatives after the last election. We're seeing more diversity. That said, people that tend to come from families that already have money and power and influence are more likely to end up in office. And so, you know, I think that things are changing. There is a generational difference, I would say. I think more people, you know, under, well, more people certainly, I think, of the post-boomer generations that are now themselves entering into either the state legislature or to Congress, a lot of them actually have student debt. So they get it in a way that I think that many people from the baby boomer generation that benefited from stronger social safety nets and cheaper access to education, I think maybe just haven't gotten. So there is a shift that is happening. It's taking some time. But if you have not been personally afflicted and you were able to pay your way through college, it's easy to dismiss this as some sort of, this is just whining or something. But the reality is when most people are whining, I don't think it's whining. There's something else going on here that's systematic. problematic.
And Jacob Dume, just to bring you in on this kind of the politics of this this part of the discussion, what do you see in terms of the influence of maybe some of these industry groups? I mean, can we sort of chalk some of this up to just profit motive? Or, you know, I mean, I think Suzanne makes an important point about just kind of people's own personal experiences or in positions of power. But what do you see in terms of who's kind of behind policies or the lack of action to address some of the challenges we've been discussing?
Yeah, I'm happy to comment. I'll certainly give the caveat that I'm no expert in this area, but I think you're right on that there's both a profit motive, for sure, and that's something I'm sure your listeners are, you know, well used to hearing, and that's the case here. Certainly the companies that are doing the servicing, certainly the industries, the for-profit industry with the current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, have the complete, you know, a lot of power in terms of how they are being policed. So you see some undue influence by corporate actors. And then, as Suzanne well pointed out, I mean, I think you have people who just maybe, you know, didn't have the problems getting themselves through school or are of the mind that everyone should just bootstrap it and have an awful time, and that's what it should be for everyone. So they're not really seeing these problems the way that we're experiencing them here and the way that we're deeply experiencing them in Black and brown communities and in very low-income communities.
Well, certainly between the cost of housing going up, the cost of tuition going up, it's the younger generation that's taking the brunt of this, unfortunately. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking about crushing student loan debt and ways to try to get out of it and address the underlying problems that are leading to this unfortunate situation for so many here in the Bay Area and beyond. Our guests tonight are Jacob Dume, Manager of Policy and Partners in San Francisco's Office of Financial Empowerment, and Juliana Fredman, a consumer protection attorney with Bay Area Legal Aid, and we're also joined by Suzanne Martindale, Senior Policy Counsel for Consumer Reports. We want to hear your questions or comments. If you have student loans and have some thoughts about what could be done to make the system better or have questions about how to address your student loan debt, we want to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Well, let's switch gears a little bit, talk about solutions. We've been kind of talking about all the problems and definitely need to, you know, delve into those and the underlying causes of how we got to where we are. But there is a bill pending in California legislature right now, AB 376, called the Student Borrower Bill of Rights. And this seems to be a kind of a leading edge bill to try to address this problem. And Suzanne Martindale, I know you've been engaged in some of the advocacy up in the Capitol around this. Can you describe a little bit about what this legislation might do?
Sure. This bill would address the crisis that we're seeing for people that are currently carrying loans. Support college affordability efforts going forward, but for the people who have already borrowed, the problem is that they have, you know, to some extent there are some rights. We do have some rights under federal law to access income-driven repayment plans to, you know, get public service loan forgiveness or disability discharge if you're severely disabled. The problem is that the federal laws that create these programs don't also give you remedies if you're treated badly. So what we're lacking is a consumer protection framework that applies to student loans the same way we have come to know and expect that for credit cards or mortgages, right? You know, how are your payments applied? When are they posted? You know, when does a company need to respond to your query? And then if they do violate the law, can you go after them? We don't have that right now for student loans. And this is a problem that we also not too long ago hadn't fixed with mortgages. You know, we had to pass in California a homeowner bill of rights after the crisis to make sure that mortgage servicers were responding to people when they said, hey, I'm struggling to repay. Can you help me out? That's what we want to do here for student loans. We're going to pass a state level framework that would ensure that there are minimum standards that every servicer has to follow, that you can get your questions answered, that you won't be steered into options that are actually going to make your loans more expensive, rack up interest, make it, you know, harder to repay. And it would also ensure that you have a legal right to take them to court if they violate the law. It's a very, very powerful right that you do have in other consumer protection contexts, whether it's the Truth in Lending Act or, you know, other kinds of laws that have been around for a while that govern other kinds of financial products. So this would really give you affirmative, enforceable rights, a consumer protection framework for you as a student loan borrower, so that if you need to get a problem fixed, well, now they're going to have an incentive to fix it for you because they don't want to be taken to court.
And so what are the prospects of this bill passing?
Well, so it's most of the way through the process. It's been out of the assembly since May. It's now currently in the Senate. It's gone through all the policy committees. It's sitting in the Senate Appropriations Committee. So it needs to get out of that committee by the end of this month, and then it will go to the Senate floor. So it needs to get out of the legislature into the governor's desk between now and September 13th. So for those who are interested, you know, call or tweet. You know, legislators do check their Twitter handles quite a bit. So the leader of the Senate, the Senate Pro Tem, Tony Atkins, the Senate Appropriations Chair, Anthony Portantino, and of course, Governor Gavin Newsom. I'll let them know if you think that this is the kind of thing that we should be doing here in the state of California.
All right. So you definitely have marching orders if you care about this bill. And I should ask, too, will this bill have national implications? I mean, is there a chance that, you know, similar way California sets standards in other industries, you know, chemical, auto emission standards, et cetera, is there a chance that if California can pass this, that this becomes the default, essentially because of the size of our market?
Absolutely. So goes California, so goes the nation. One out of every eight human beings in this country lives in California. But in California alone, 3.8 million people have student loans. It's like, I think, $141 billion that we hold here in California. And so for these, you know, the companies that are out there doing this loan servicing, these are large. They're all out of state. They're not headquartered in California. These are large multinational corporations. They're publicly traded. And so if they have to, and, you know, and so some of the things that are in this bill, you know, they're just industry best practices anyway. It shouldn't be that big of a deal to comply. But we do suspect that if they have to comply with a new regime in California, that it could well lead to nationwide change. And other states around the country are also looking at doing bills of rights similar to what we're trying to do here in California.
Right. So maybe California can be a leader in this field, too. So let's go to the phone lines. We have Glenda from San Francisco calling in. Glenda, welcome.
Hi. This is such a timely topic for me. I try to communicate with the Consumer Financial Bureau that's supposed to help you, you know, try to figure out how to resolve your issues with Navient, and it was like Alice in Wonderland. They figured out a way not to even resolve any of my issues. And then I contacted Navient again, and they sent me some disclaimer that stated that because I had a Parent Plus loan, that the interest is paid first, and I get that, but there's no rhyme or reason how they've been applying my payments to the principal. They actually sent me a summary, and it's just insane. I was wondering, what do you guys suggest I do? Because I have not gotten any sort of satisfaction. I have two children. My other child, her loan was smaller, but it was more recent. It was a large sum of money paid off, because they have appropriately applied the payments to the interest and the principal. This loan is just crazy.
All right, Glenda. Well, I'm sorry you're struggling with this. So let me direct this to Suzanne to weigh in.
Well, this is precisely why our California bill is needed. And so you prompted me to want to mention as well that what we want to create through this state legislation is a state-level borrower advocate or ombudsman person. You know, we had at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau under the previous director, Richard Cordray, an office for students and young consumers, and there was a student loan ombudsman position. And the two people that occupied that position, Rohit Chopra and followed by Seth Frotman, were both very, very diligent about responding to complaints and escalating complaints, particularly if they involved the Department of Education because it was a federal loan, to really make sure that if you file a complaint, you're going to get a prompt response and we're going to try and help you fix that problem. But unfortunately, under the current leadership of CFPB Director Kathy Kraninger, they've really abandoned a lot of their work to help borrowers. They just hired a new ombudsman who is a former executive from Fed Loan Servicing, so a former industry executive, and we're very concerned about how he's going to implement his duties at that job. So we believe that, you know, so for now, keep your paperwork. Juliana may have some other thoughts. It's tough situation.
I was going to ask if Juliana, if you have thoughts for Glenda in this situation.
You know, it's pretty hard to opine without looking at the paperwork, but I would say that you could check the clinic times and bring them by and we could try to talk it through with you.
All right. Well, Glenda, good luck with that. And we've got.
So what is the organization you were with? I was driving.
And no, Glenda, I was just about to say that we actually just put some of the resources on our website. It's the Bay Area Legal Aid. And we also have links to the San Francisco Office of Empowerment. And we have information on AB 376, the state bill that Suzanne was just mentioning. And we have the Public Service Forgiveness Loan Form. So please, for you and others listening in, please do go to the website to see those resources. So thank you so much, Glenda, and good luck with what you are dealing with. And I wanted to share a comment. Karen from Berkeley writes in that Congress changed the bankruptcy law in 2005, right before the financial crisis. And this was alluded earlier to, I believe, Suzanne, you mentioned this, and made it harder for people like students to declare bankruptcy. They knew that there was a problem coming, and they amended the bankruptcy law on purpose. And Karen, thank you for that comment. And it really points to how this is a federal issue to a large extent. Obviously, there's things we can do at the state level. But Jacob Dumais, what kind of federal help or policy changes would make your life easier? I mean, here we are on the ground in the Bay Area dealing with this implications of this system. But what kind of federal changes would be useful that you would like to see?
It's a good question. You know, I think we need some wholesale changes at the Department of Education on a number of fronts, certainly in the way that they vet and hire and undergo the oversight that involves these loans being serviced, the terms of the loans, interest rates, et cetera. It seems like a common sense, both sides of the aisle issue to address the bankruptcy issue. You're getting hard to find a politician who's going to really defend that as just a great thing when, you know, almost anybody you know has somebody with a student debt problem. You know, how they track the data on colleges. It's very intentional now that the department puts out maybe a 3-year, I think, is the standard for a default rate. And so you see how many people are defaulting after 3 years, and that's supposed to help you make your decision, and that's how the colleges are judged by. Well, that spikes after 5 years. It continues to rise 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. So a lot of these functions need to be addressed. I'll be frank, we're not really looking for that to happen anytime soon. And I'll be honest, we can point to this current administration as standing out in terms of some of the bad stuff that's happening in this area. But the Department of Ed wasn't so great under President Obama either. There were plenty of problems there. So we are really looking to the state legislation, AB 376 being part of that, a whole host of pieces of legislation addressing for-profit colleges in California, which are also very important, and we hope to see those passed. TCAS is an organization, again, that I mentioned in Oakland that is really backing that fight. And then locally here, we're really looking at how can we help the people who are struggling right now today, because any of the changes I'm talking about are for the next generation of borrowers in many cases, or potentially some relief. But it's why we're looking to really support and fund legal aid, consumer rights clinics, debt clinics where people can get help. And I'll note Bay Area Legal Aid doesn't just do that in San Francisco. They do that in, what, 6 or 7 counties all around the Bay Area. So you can find help there. And other organizations are in that fight as well. We're looking to partner with our school district in San Francisco. And they have been a really great partner in acknowledging that this is a problem, because there's a whole push to get people to go to college. And San Francisco has been pretty darn good at that, I'd say. But are they completing college? Are they having problems with the debt after that? So we're looking at college affordability counseling and really helping people make informed decisions to and through college. And then what can we do for people that are saying, yeah, but I have this debt now, and, you know, there's a lot we want to do, but I think one of the first steps is to at least know that we've mentioned income-driven repayment a couple of times. You know, that's a really smart plan. Is it perfect? No. But going into delinquency and default is a really bad thing for your financial life. And so income-driven repayment helps you avoid that. Right now, I think maybe, what, a third of the people who qualify for income-driven repayment, if that maybe, are enrolled in that plan. So we would like to sort of run out a targeted campaign for these hardest hit areas to make sure at least you're taking advantage of that.
And this is all through the Office of Financial Empowerment at the city, right?
Office of Financial Empowerment, although we can't do this without a number of partnerships, legal aid organizations, the school district, local colleges, nonprofits, so yes.
And Juliana, I wanted to ask you if you have thoughts to share about resources for people and also just kind of what you're looking towards in terms of, you know, changes from up on high that might make your life easier.
Yeah, well, I mean, the changes from up on high feel very, you know, broad. It's a difficult situation. I think that what we are looking at a lot of time as a legal services organization is triage, right? And it's like, what, as Jacob said, it's getting people into income-driven plans, screening people who might be eligible for some kind of a discharge or other options. I mean, there's people all the time who come in, they're on disability, and their disability is being taken to pay for the loans, but there's a disability discharge for federal student loans, you know. So there's all sorts of issues around servicing and people understanding even the options that are available within the kind of limited options that are available in the federal student loan world.
And any good resources people should look to before they take out loans?
Jacob?
I, the one that comes to mind, because it's just they did a good job putting together resources on the website. I don't know if it's for pre-borrowing as much as it is for all stages of lending, but the National Consumer Law Center, NCLC. So if you Google NCLC or National Consumer Law Center and pair that with student debt or student borrowing, you'll find their website.
Student Loan Borrowers Assistance, they have a website that's consumer-facing, and they do talk about all these issues. I don't know if they talk too much about pre-borrowing situations as much as how to deal with your loans once you have them, but it is a good comprehensive kind of overview of the different options available once you have the loan.
We'll be sure to also put those resources on our website, so KALW.org for those listening. That we'll put all of our resources that we've listed, all the websites there. And Suzanne, I wanted to ask you about the presidential promises and to see if you've been sort of tracking what some of the candidates, at least on the Democratic side, have been saying about this issue. I mean, we know that Senator Booker, Mayor Buttigieg, Castro, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, they all have various plans to try to deal with student debt. Anything that really jumps out at you as particularly groundbreaking or just a great idea or something, or maybe a bad idea that you think people should be alerted to?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I work at a 501c3 nonprofit where we avoid, you know, the electoral aspect of policy, but so I don't endorse candidates and et cetera. But, you know, I think what is really encouraging to me is that this time around, it's a major topic. I mean, it's become such of a of an important cultural and societal issue that serious presidential candidates feel that they have to have a plan to address it. And the plans are range from, you know, in their levels of complexity or generosity, but the fact that there are people who are everything from wanting to expand or make better public service loan forgiveness options to some people saying we should, you know what, this is too complex and we screwed it up too bad, we just need to cancel the debt. I mean, very interesting to hear several candidates talk about outright debt cancellation. And I think that a lot of the credit comes to the fore for, I would definitely credit the folks at the Debt Collective. You know, these are students who across the country, many of them in California, who went to the disgraced Corinthian colleges. They were defrauded. They were ripped off. And then when they were being told by the Department of Education, oh, you still need to pay these loans, they said, you know what, this is immoral, we're not going to pay. And so they initiated a debt strike, and that debt strike led to a 2016 regulation that actually created a new process called a borrower defense process so that you could say, look, if the school misled you, you know, make your case, and maybe the government will actually just cancel your debt. And so I think that the fact that they were so courageous enough, given how risky it is to default on a loan, to do that, to say this is morally wrong. We were told to get an education. We sought an education. We were given nothing, a worthless experience, and then we're stuck with the debt. That's immoral. Really, I think, made it possible for presidential candidates to feel that it's politically viable to even suggest just canceling the debt altogether.
So it's a good sign that this is now on the radar, and we just have about a minute left. So, Jacob, I'm just going to ask you the last question, which is if you've noticed a shifting perception in this discussion around debt, you know, shifting sort of demographics, politics, and just people's attitudes about student loan debt. Have you seen that in your position at the city?
Well, you know, so I'm not a longtime student debt expert. And as I took this up, there was some thought of, you know, what kind of traction we could get. So what I would say is immediately, yes, everybody is interested when you talk student debt. And we found that our school district is receptive, and we found that college systems and the governor's office is very receptive. So can I speak to changing, you know, mores on this over the last decades? Not necessarily, but it's been really great. And I want to give a quick shout out to my co-author, Bina Shramali at the Fed, who, you know, again, she's a public health researcher and, you know, and talks about the economy at large. But great to have her support on this.
All right. Well, I'm glad to know there are folks working like yourselves on this issue and trying to make it right for those who are struggling with student loan debt. We're going to have to leave the conversation there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Jacob Dumais from San Francisco's Office of Financial Empowerment, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Juliana Fredman from Bay Area Legal Aid. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Suzanne Martindale from Consumer Reports.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to all of you for listening in. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer tonight was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Grace Wan. Join us next week when Grace Wan will actually be hosting and sitting down with author Laura Bass of University of San Francisco Law School to discuss issues of restorative justice. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.